From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Benjamin Bombard. The food writer and cultural historian John T. Edge has tried his hand at selling street food. A few years back, he celebrated New Year's Eve by selling hot dogs to drunken revelers in New Orleans' French Quarter. John T. Edge has a new cookbook out, but it's not simply a collection of recipes. It's also a travelogue, documenting the year he spent eating his way across America's urban streets. The book is also a cultural exploration of a unique moment in American cuisine. In the midst of a sour economy, enterprising people are taking a different road to a new kind of restaurant ownership. Edge says that if you accept street food for what it is, if you eat it on its own terms, it can open doors to different people and different places. It can even change our understanding of foreign customs. The modern American street food scene, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Benjamin Bombard, filling in for Doug Fabrizio, who's on vacation. John T. Edge loves street food. He had to eat a lot of it to research his new book. On first glance, his Truck Food Cookbook is a collection of recipes, a straightforward enough cookbook. But at its heart, the book is a cultural document, an exploration of a unique moment in American cuisine when people across the country, under the pressures of a poor economy, are choosing to forgo brick-and-mortar restaurants, choosing instead to sell delicious food from mobile kitchens, serving up dishes to eaters hungry for what Edge calls honest food. When John T. Edge hit the road a couple years back to feast on street food, the revolution was in its early years. It was already well established in a couple cities, like Portland, Oregon and Austin, Texas. But meanwhile, other cities were actively trying to curate street food scenes. By and large, it seems that America and its civic management are still warming to the idea of mobile restaurants. Regulations in many cities make it a challenge to hawk a jazzed-up falafel or Korean sandwich from downtown parking lots. John T. Edge's new cookbook offers recipes for at-home cooks to recreate some of the dishes he tasted during his street food quest, and it just might inspire some new food truck entrepreneurs to hit the streets. We're talking with John T. Edge today about the street food revolution, where it came from, where to find it, and where it's heading. You can join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. That's 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter. John T. Edge is the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, an institute at the University of Mississippi that focuses on food culture. Edge writes a monthly column called United Tastes for the New York Times. Among his many books are Donuts, An American Passion, and A Gracious Plenty, Recipes and Recollections from the American South. John T. Edge will be in Salt Lake City tomorrow to talk about his new book, The Truck Food Cookbook, and he's joining us from the community public radio station KPFT in Houston, Texas. John T. Edge, welcome to Radio West. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, and thanks for such a kind and thorough introduction.
You open your new book, John T. Edge, The Truck Food Cookbook, with some thoughts about your travels in Vietnam a few years back. I guess you read something, you were sitting on the streets of Vietnam eating some street food, and you read something that spurred your thoughts about street food around the world and in India and in Vietnam and back here in the States. What was it that you read? What were you thinking at the time? And I guess kind of maybe first, what were you eating?
I was eating everything in sight, it seemed. And in Vietnam, it was my first traveling there, and I spent 2 weeks in the country. Flew into Saigon and then flew out of Hanoi. And I was struck in Vietnam by the vibrancy of, the freshness of, the democracy of street food there. There are kind of a number of moments when I'm literally sitting on the curb with my rear end on the curb and my feet in the literal gutter. One, I can remember eating a banh mi sandwich, talking to the cook who had assembled the banh mi sandwich, and it had this beautiful fresh cilantro. It tasted sharper and brighter than I can recall before. And sure, some of that's about the heightened experience, heightened awareness you get with travel. But some of it's just about really great, beautiful, bright cilantro. And I asked her where that cilantro came from, and she motioned to a garden plot about 10 feet away. So this was her regular stall, the regular place she sold banh mi, those kind of Vietnamese po'boys, Vietnamese hoagies. And she was growing the cilantro right there. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't doing that to establish menu provenance like a white tablecloth chef would. She was growing cilantro there because that was the frugal thing to do, the kind of economical, both in time and effort, thing to do. And it struck me then, you know, why don't we, at that point, and this is 2007, 2008, mm-hmm. I was asking myself, why don't we have great street food based on great ingredients in the U.S.? And that was kind of an epiphanic moment for me. At the same time, you know, as I was traveling through Vietnam, I'm reading stories about India, the kind of citadel of street food in the world. And India was beginning to lock down street food, was beginning to regulate it and perhaps arguably regulated out of existence. Hmm. So I saw kind of an American moment in India. We had regulated our street food out of business, and yet I saw this beautiful street food in Vietnam, and both those currents are running through my head.
Mm-hmm. This kind of gets to a term you use frequently in your book, honest food. Is this kind of what you're getting at, the freshness, the closeness to the food that street food presents, honest food?
Yeah, I mean, there's another way to think about honest food, and it's probably the way I most frequently think about it. I think the term authentic is really useless now. I mean, when Joe's Crab House, you know, a chain that sets up in Walmart parking lots, claims to be serving authentic crab, or McDonald's wants to sell you an authentic, Tejano torta, then that term has been rendered kind of meaningless. And what's more, I see in street food, in phenomenons like the Kogi truck in L.A., mm-hmm. Which serves and really kind of made popular Korean tacos. That sounds like fusion food, which oftentimes when we use that term, we're implying a certain dishonesty, as if there's a shotgun marriage of two cultures or two instincts. And yet, is that food authentic? Is it, I don't know how to use that term. I think it's honest because it reflects Roy Choi, the founder of Kogi, is Korean-American, and he grew up in a neighborhood rich with Mexican-Americans. And that marriage of Kalbi or galbi, however you care to pronounce it, Korean short ribs, on a flatbread, in essence a tortilla, a corn tortilla, topped with kimchi, is to me honest food. It's an honest reflection of his place. And I think that term might be more useful, perhaps, than authenticity, which, you know, I find kind of problematic.
Mm-hmm. And you've eaten at hundreds of food trucks across the country. Well, I guess first, How does street food in America differ from street food around the world, especially in its early days, the early days of street food in America, the New Guard, which we'll get into later, the New Guard versus the Old Guard?
The origins of street food in America are, you know, as elemental as immigration, and as important as immigration, a facet of immigration. You know, if you got off at Ellis Island and were processed and then ended up on the docks in New York, you were more than likely met by someone selling street food, selling sausages and hard rolls. If you jumped ship in the harbor in New Orleans and say you were Italian-American, you'd be met with something similar in that locale. You know, the great age of immigrations, late 1800s, early 1900s, really early 1900s, street food abounded. And then came, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle and revelations about meat processing and the like. And we as a country begin to kind of codify and regulate out of existence anything at the margins. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of nationalism that runs rampant as well, wherein immigrants are encouraged strongly to rid themselves of such, you know, horrific smells as garlic. There's a mainstreaming of our food that, runs kind of parallel to World War I and World War II, wherein we're building this nationalistic ideal and identity, and our food reflects that. And we kind of legislate and curate street food out of existence in many places, not all places.
Enforce it all indoors, as it were.
Force it indoors, a garlicky sausage into a bland hot dog. We tamp down flavors and ethnicities, and at the same time, yes, we force it indoors. We develop health and sanitation regulations that are reacting to a real problem that Sinclair, brought to light in the jungle. But, you know, as with many things of regulation, we go too far. And we end up with something, you know, we drive street food indoors, we drive street food underground.
Mm-hmm. Before we talk a little more about the history of street food in America, what is it about the experience of street food? You've eaten it hundreds, I imagine, maybe more, yeah, food carts across the country. What makes it a different experience from going into a restaurant and ordering, a taco? There are plenty of brick and mortar taco restaurants. Why go to a street food stand?
One thing is because you get to engage in this absurd moment when you stand at a taco truck, and you know how many of them have those kind of fold down stainless steel shelves, mm-hmm, that are quite narrow and fold down from the truck, and you get to order a taco from a truck that has wheels and may drive off in 15 minutes. And you get to answer the question, which is oftentimes asked of me, which is that for here or to go? Mm-hmm. Which I think is kind of an existential bizarro question. That was intended as a joke. Obviously, it didn't work. but it's always funny to me that somebody asked me, is that for here or to go? As if, everything wasn't to go off the side of a taco truck. But the other thing that I think is more important, to get at in your question is, I think one of the things that street food, truck food offers is this intimacy of exchange between the cook and the eater. Mm-hmm. I think about kind of that moment in the 1980s when chefs were selling us on chef's tables. And the idea was you paid $150, and you sat in the back in the sweaty kitchen in reach of the chef. And the chef wore, a white toque, which you could see up above the grease and heat. And you paid that extra money for that chef to prepare dishes for you and then hand them to you. You paid, I would argue, for that intimacy. He cooks, you eat. And in most cases in this era, it was male cooks. He cooks, you eat. The chef hands you food and you eat it. And I think as interest in American food culture matures, and as Americans mature in their kind of connoisseurship and knowledge of food in this country, I think one of the reasons, or one of the ways, that they're now responding to street food is that this is a way to establish an intimate relationship with your cook. In many trucks and carts, I remember being not that long ago in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and there was this place called Jeppa Joe's. Mm-hmm. And Jeppa Joe, this guy who taught English as a second language in Asia and come back home, and now he was making banh mi. And he was in a small cart. There was only room for one person in that cart. And I watched, as I stood in line for one of his sandwiches, I watched everyone walk up, and there's that moment, he looks him in the eye, he takes their money, then he puts on a glove, makes their sandwich, and hands it to them. And I think people love that exchange. They love, it's the kind of commercial equivalent of your mama making something at the stove and pivoting to hand it to you at the kitchen counter.
Yeah. And street food in America, you say it went into hiding for a little bit. It was kind of regulated out of existence. We had, you write about the Chili Queens of San Antonio back in the day, tamales sold in Austin at the turn of the 20th century, callow women in New Orleans, old guard hot dog vendors in New York. And then it kind of went underground for a while, it seems. But there was always kind of an undercurrent. Wasn't there the trucks that go to the construction sites and stuff?
Sure.
What helped bring it all back out onto the streets?
I think you're right. It always was there. It may have been out of the eyes of Anglo-America, but taco trucks, whether you're in Los Angeles, California, or Tucson, Arizona, or Salt Lake City, there have been for a long while taco trucks. But a lot of white America didn't pay attention until, until downshifting chefs began riffing on taco trucks and opening, I mentioned kind of the phenomenon of Korean barbecue banh mi sandwiches and cupcakes and all the kind of what have become kind of the codified dishes of the haute street food, truck food movement. Mm-hmm.
The new guard, as you say.
Yeah, new guard. I mean, much of America wasn't paying attention. And yet I would argue that any cook now working one of these high-end haute, new guard carts is riffing directly on what Mexican-American taco truck cooks have been doing for a couple of generations, paying homage to it without perhaps knowledge of, where the idea might have come from. But the idea and the form is very much the Mexican-American taco truck.
Mm-hmm. And you write that there are two types of cities that took this idea of the taco truck and street food and blew it up. They expanded on it and they made it a real part of the culture there. You focus on two different tiers of street food cities in your books, the primary and the secondary. You say primary cities like being Portland and Austin, Texas, and then secondary cities like Minneapolis and Tucson, I guess. What's the difference between these two tiers of cities and how they've approached street food?
Well, there's some cities like Austin and like Portland that have either in Houston, Texas, too, that allowed by way of benign neglect or, and later by way of progressive leadership, allowed this to happen, in that true sense of the word, allowed it to happen, allowed this kind of grassroots movement to build. And I think Portland's probably the best example of that. The city, this kind of scene developed wherein they have these pods, a number of them scattered around town, three within walking distance of the core of downtown, and that developed over time. And it reached a point where city planners begin writing white papers exploring the positive impact of street food on the vitality of the city. Mm-hmm. So I don't think Portland set out to craft itself, make itself into a street food capital of the U.S., but I think Portland recognized the merits of the carts and then began to build a system of support for them.
Hmm. And that system go ahead.
Go ahead, please.
And that system of support is example how? How does that in the regulations, is it just allowing carts to be there? Is it relaxing regulations for safety and health? Or,
well, there are a number of cities and I know Salt Lake City went through this and is in discussions about this. Mm-hmm. Los Angeles for a while, wanted to limit the amount of time that a taco truck could park in any one space. And this affected the oat trucks, but it affected even more so the traditional taco trucks. Mm-hmm. So an organization formed called Las Loncheros that worked on, in essence, whose focus was workers' rights, the rights of these new immigrants to sell their goods on public streets and to serve their customers. I think that kind of effort is important. So that's NGO, non-governmental effort. Mm-hmm. But you also see cities that begin to see the value of street food as a catalyst for street life. Street food as, in Portland, an attraction, a cultural tourism attraction, mm-hmm. where people build vacations not to go to the museum and then go eat at a truck, but to go eat at carts or trucks and then maybe go see a museum.
That's the food writer and cultural historian John T. Edge. His most recent book is called The Truck Food Cookbook. Tomorrow morning at 11:30, Edge will talk about his book in the parking lot of Trolley Square here in Salt Lake City. He's here as a guest of Weller Bookworks, and you'll also be able to buy lunch from Salt Lake's own Chow Truck, who we'll be talking about later in the conversation. For more information on that event, visit us at radiowest.kuer.org. We have to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Benjamin Bombard, sitting in for Doug Fabrizio. We're joined today by John T. Edge, the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, a food writer and cultural historian. He's talking to us about his new cookbook, The Truck Food Cookbook. And John T. Edge will be in town tomorrow to talk about his book and to eat some truck food with us here in Salt Lake City. So we'll have more information about that as we go along. John T. Edge, we were talking a bit about Portland before the break there, and Portland is in many ways, it seems, the vanguard of the food truck scene, as we were talking about. And I'd like you to contrast for us, if you would, Portland, which you say has a kind of DIY, a do-it-yourselfy feel to its trucks and its food, and with Los Angeles, which, if I get it right, is much more curated and hip and with it? Am I, is that too much? Or?
Well, I think, you know, if there is a trendiness to this, and there certainly is, I would argue that the trend will pass and this way of eating will continue on. Mm-hmm. But if there's a place where, you know, food trucks and the like are trendiest, if there's a place where, you know, a truck upon opening is as likely to get, you know, to engage a PR firm as it is to get a second fry basket, then it's L.A. I had this really absurd and a great conversation with one of the people I wrote about in the book, this place called the Grilled Cheese Truck.
Uh-huh.
That sets up in Venice in a parking lot at a bar called The Brig. And there's three or four trucks that set up there. And they make this really great sandwich called it's a grilled cheese mac and cheese. So it's, you know.
Rich.
It's rich. It's, you know, my son's 11. It's food suited for my son. And it's also food suited for people who have a snootful, you know, at 2 a.m. mm-hmm. But the gentleman about whom I wrote, and I wrote nice things about that truck because I really admire the inventiveness of that sandwich, called me to say that you know, I had written about his tater tots, and I'd written about the fact that they, when I visited them, were putting sumac on them, mm-hmm. and I love that Persian spice. It's in other cultures too, but I know it from Persian food. I thought it cut the grease and tater tots mm-hmm. really well. And he called to say that they had changed their tot strategy, and that was not reflective of what their concept was about. Huh. And that, to me, was the perfect L.A. moment.
Was it too Portland-y for them?
No, just the idea that, like, he was in full control of his marketing message for his truck, and that I would, you know, that I didn't update my book to reflect his new tot strategy was an absurd moment. I understood and you know, appreciated his want to control his marketing message, but, you know, I'm writing a book. I write what I observe and what I like, and my job is not to, you know, to valorize him and to discern his tot marketing strategy. And that, you know, that L.A., it's big business. L.A., it matters a lot. L.A., you know, this trend is, you know, is reflects the kind of marketing pressures and abilities of L.A. Does that make sense?
It does. And up the coast a ways in San Francisco. You say that staying on the West Coast, you say that San Francisco still hasn't quite found its aesthetic, like L.A. with its trendiness and Portland with its DIY scene. It's still kind of a middle child trying to figure out its way in the world. I liked one character that you wrote about, Natalie Galitzer. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, Natalie, who has Bike Basket Pies.
Yeah, can you tell us about Natalie?
She's a brilliant young woman. What she did in a very, you know, very reflective of the aesthetic of San Francisco, she lives in the Mission, and I'll come back to this, in this conversation, we'll talk about San Francisco and talk about the Mission and its importance. But she lives in the Mission, and she rides a bike, and she collects windfall fruit, so the fruit that falls off of trees in public spaces that is, in essence, anyone's for the taking, lemons and the like. And she makes pies from that and delivers those pies via that same bicycle that she tools about the neighborhood in. So, you know, this kind of the fruitivore, or, you know, locavore, and I'm losing the name for the people who glean
Freegans.
From the garbage. Freegans, yes. Yeah. So she reflects all those Freegans and vores, and she bakes a beautiful shaker lemon pie, which we include a recipe for in the book. But I admired her pluck. I admired the marketing skills. I admired her, you know, use of Twitter in a playful kind of come hither kind of way. Really smart woman.
And she reflects one thing that I noticed about a number of the street food entrepreneurs that you write about in your book, that they come from every background that you can imagine. Some of them are Trey Corcoran of the Swamp Shack in Portland is a professional photographer by training. Thomas DeGeest at Waffles and is it Ding?
Waffles and Dingies. Yeah.
Dingies in New York City, a former IBM consultant. And Natalie herself was a molecular biology major.
Exactly.
They come from all walks of life. And is that a reflection of the down economy, people looking for work, looking to reinvent themselves?
I think it's a reflection of that kind of this moment in the American economic history, wherein there's not a lot of capital and there is a lot of need for self recreation, to make your own job in this moment matters, and you need to. I also think it's a reflection of a new generation of young people for whom food entrepreneurship is the hip thing to do. Food entrepreneurship is the sexy thing to do. Food entrepreneurship is the au courant, expression or au courant way to express yourself and to express your ideas, your values about the world. It's the rock and roll of the moment.
Speaking of rock and roll, let's talk about Austin, Texas real quick. You write about Flip Happy Crepe in Austin. The ladies who own and operate Flip Happy Crepe, you say they were part of the vanguard of contemporary street food proprietors. They adopted the use of an Airstream van, which I guess was innovative back in the early days of the street food scene. And you say they curated a public gathering space and kind of cultivated an aesthetic, and that kind of laid the groundwork for a lot of what we see today in the street food scene. Can you tell us about Flip Happy Crepe?
Yeah. I mean, Flip Happy Crepe is, I think one of the most distinctive things about them is that, we have this image in our head of trucks and trailers and carts really being movable, feasts, something that is at this corner one day and at another corner the next. But Flip Happy Crepes does not move about. Flip Happy Crepes stays in one place, this big open kind of graveled plaza where there are little French bistro tables and some tinning in case of rain and big oaks kind of spanning the space. And they have curated this great outdoor kind of picnic ground.
And there just happens to be an Airstream trailer there, blasting Donna Summer music. One moment in Edith Piaf, the next. Mm-hmm. They not only are cooking food, but they've created this, this place to lounge about, this place to incubate community.
Well, and doesn't
and I think that's important.
Does that kind of fly in the face of your definition of street food as having the potential? I guess it's the potential. Right. The potential is there that this Airstream van could move one day.
Correct. That's the conceit. Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, and a lot of these, the carts in Portland don't move often, but they have the potential to move. And, you know, as I began looking around the country, I had to find a way to categorize all this and to put self-applied blinders on. And I decided that I would not include places like kiosks or windows where you can purchase food and then walk down the street.
No snow cone shacks.
Right. No snow cone shacks, no, you know, crepe windows, no, mm-hmm. There's so many great places, no hot dog windows. I grew up in the South, and there were always the pool rooms in the South, the Deep South, served hot dogs. And there would always be a window cut in the front of it so that women and children might walk up and get a hot dog from the window, because women and children wouldn't dare grace the smoke film nastiness of a billiard parlor in the South. Pool room. You'd never say billiard parlor in the South. A pool room in the South. So, but I cut that stuff out and then came back to, does this conveyance from which this food is served, does it have the possibility of movement? Mm-hmm. And, yeah, the flip-happy crepe trailer was rolled into place and could be rolled out tomorrow.
Let's talk real quick about hot dogs. Hot dogs, in some ways, they laid the groundwork, it seems, on top, along with tacos and tamales, historically, for street food. And hot dogs still, they take up a significant section of your book here. And especially, can you tell us some about the Sonoran hot dog, which is this unique and, I would say, probably quite filling concoction out of Tucson.
Yeah, so in Tucson, there are, by my count and by the count of friends who are folklorists there, 100 or more gentlemen who style themselves, and others call them the same, hot dogueros. So these are Mexican-American men who most of whom hail from Hermosillo, which is the capital of Sonora, the state immediately south of Arizona. Mm-hmm. And they vend these hot dogs that have been kind of candy cane wrapped with bacon and then flat top fried until the bacon and the hot dog fuse into one. And then served from stands, and most of the stands are, just self-contained units. Many have a Ramada, which is not a cheap motel, but is an awning that stretches from some pole set 10 feet away from the cart and the cart itself. So there's a little bit of shade for sitting and eating your hot dog, which you need in Tucson. Mm-hmm. And they tuck these candy cane wrapped bacon hot dogs in bolillo buns, a Mexican bakery kind of engorged hot dog bun looking thing. And then they dress it by taking what amounts to the entire contents of a taco truck. and I'm being a little hyperbolic, but not really. You might see, you'd see certainly stewed pinto beans on it. You'd see jalapeno salsa, fresh made, really bright jalapeno salsa, and we include a recipe for that salsa in the book, and it's so elemental and so good. And then mayonnaise and mustard, no ketchup usually, and then everything else you can imagine. But those are the base ingredients: the beans, the jalapeno salsa, the mustard, mayonnaise. And in Tucson, I would argue that for the most part, the standard American hot dog with mustard and ketchup and maybe onions is irrelevant. It is, you know, you see in this food, in this really delicious food, the remaking of America by Mexican-American immigrants. And you thank them very much because it's a better hot dog than that those dirty water steamed hot dogs that are kind of, you know, the ballpark kind of, or those roller hot dogs you get at the convenience store.
Yeah.
Dreck. But these are really great, and the price point is really low. And they're served oftentimes with torritos, which are huero peppers, the kind of ghost yellow peppers, fairly mild, stuffed with some Mexican melting cheese or some mozzarella, wrapped as well in bacon, in this kind of corset of bacon. And then those are flat top fried, and that comes as your side. And then when you buy it, you are welcome to step to the Salsero bar to load up with everything from cucumbers to, you know, to four or five different kind of fresh made sauces, including chili de arbol and the like. So you can tell I'm getting wound up. I love those hot dogs.
Hey, what does a plate of Sonoran hot dogs go for with all the fixings?
$3? Yeah.
For all that food. And yeah. So that raises a question for me with part of the experience, and I would probably argue that this is more true of the taco stand experience than the Oak Cuisine food truck experience, is dressing it all up, however you will. Standing there in front of a smoking hot grill and then taking your tacos and putting your salsas and cucumbers and radishes and what have you on there. And one question that came to mind when I was reading through your book, John T. Edge, was that is something lost in the translation from the street to the kitchen with the recipes?
I mean, you lose that great democratic moment of standing online. You lose the kind of you know, the kind of elbow rubbing moment where a construction worker is standing next to you know, a pierced hipster is standing next to, you know, some a lady who's on the commute from her bridge game to her home. In my experience in cooking from the book after writing the book, the recipes, a lot of which are 4 to 6 ingredient recipes, translate pretty well from the book or from the truck to the home. Because think about it, you know, if you're at home, I don't really want to attempt, especially on a weeknight, something that has more than 4 to 6 ingredients.
Yeah.
I don't want to go back out to the grocery store. I'm working in a fairly small space. I'm sure on your public radio salary, you make tons more than me. But my kitchen's small. You know, I work for a university, so my salary's not grand. And neither is our house, and our kitchen's small. I love the space. But I'm working in a small space, kind of like a taco truck owner, a small kitchen. And I'm working with a limited amount of time if it's a weeknight. You know, so I think the recipes actually do translate pretty well. Sure, you're going to lose that, the kind of heartbeat of the street. But the recipes themselves, it's a watermelon agua fresca in there that I've been drinking a lot this summer. You know, it's just watermelon and water and a little bit of lime and a tiny bit of sugar. And it's the most refreshing, beautiful morning drink, and it plays pretty well with rum or vodka, too.
The food writer and cultural historian John T. Edge. His most recent book is called The Truck Food Cookbook, and he'll be reading from it tomorrow morning at 11:30. He'll be talking about it at the parking lot at Trolley Square here in Salt Lake City. He's here as a guest of Weller Bookworks, and you'll also be able to buy lunch from Salt Lake's own Chow Truck there at the event. For more information, visit us at radiowest.kuer.org. We have to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Benjamin Bombard, sitting in today for Doug Fabrizio. We're joined right now by the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, John T. Edge. He's also a food writer and cultural historian. And we'd like to welcome onto the program right now Ted Scheffler. He's the dining editor for the Salt Lake City Weekly. He also writes for Park City Magazine. And Ted Scheffler is joining us by phone from here in Salt Lake City. Ted Scheffler, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Mm-hmm.
Ted, I wonder if you could give us a sense quickly of Salt Lake street food scene. I guess it starts in large part with, as with many cities, the numerous taco carts here. Give us a sense of some of the selection that we can find on the streets of Salt Lake City, if you would.
Well, yeah, you know, it's funny. Just coincidentally, I was just writing an article last week about food trucks for City Weekly. It's not out yet, but it'll be out in a week or so. And I was looking at John's book, and I was surprised. I've known about food carts here, especially taco carts. I mean, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so many, I can't even begin. I thought about doing an article called A La Carte, you know, about food carts here. And I was just so overwhelmed. I couldn't figure out how to begin to sort of, you know, discriminate from one between them all. And so it's a little easier to focus on the food carts, mm-hmm. or I mean on the food trucks. But still, I was surprised because in my research, I found at least 16 food trucks along the Wasatch Front here. And there are a few that are, you know, pretty well known, like the Chow Truck, mm-hmm. and maybe the Better Burger Truck and a few others. But, you know, the flavors here range from, like, Chuvi Duvi, which is a truck selling Mexican-style treats. Street tacos, and one called Como Lomo, which has a Peruvian fare, there are three pizza trucks that I'm aware of doing, like, wood-fired pizzas right on the spot. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, your typical sandwich and burger places, and then, you know, places doing desserts. There's a crepes truck called Crepes on a Roll, and a place that does ice or the Snow Cupcake truck, which does cupcakes and ice cream. So, a really wide variety.
So, and are these recent additions to our streets in Salt Lake City, or have a few of them been around a little while?
Yeah, I think a lot of them are pretty pretty recent. You know, mm-hmm. within the last year. So, I think this is I'm not certain of this, but the first food truck that I was aware of, and I'm not talking about the little sandwich places that mm-hmm. go to construction sites. You know, those have been around for forever. You know, the little deli trucks, but the dedicated food truck. The first one that I really became aware of was Sue Ann Chow's truck, which is called the Chow Truck, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and they specialize in sort of Asian influenced tacos and stuff like flash fried calamari, panko fried tofu, mm-hmm. Stuff like that. And that's sort of the first one that I became aware of. And then, like I said, doing this research, I found some that I was totally unaware of. And one, John was mentioning the place. I believe it was a crepes place in Ogden that's situated in an Airstream trailer, and we have a place like that in Bountiful, and it's really interesting. It's called I'm going to forget the name now, but it's called Smokestream. It's a barbecue place, and they've taken an Airstream Silver Bullet trailer and turned it into this smokehouse barbecue restaurant, and it's movable. For the most part, it stays stationary on Main Street in Bountiful. But they also do actually their own, they make these trailers. If you want to buy a trailer from them, they'll customize it for you and turn it into a food trailer. So that's a pretty cool thing. It's called Smokestream, and you can find them on smokestream.com, one word.
We'll put a link to that on our website. Yeah. John T. Edge, you've written some about the investment in the process of getting these trucks going. So they can cost upwards of, where is it in? Atlanta, that you mentioned there's a program that you can take out a $400,000 loan with the city to pay for a truck?
Oh, yeah, that was a failed project in another city. You can, you know, if you look at a city like Portland, Oregon, because there's such a density of carts and because they're working with, in many cases, you know, these small teardrop trailers or, you know, what looks like a hurdy-gurdy wagon. I don't really know what the basis for some of these are. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can get a there's a good bit of turn in that business in Portland. You can get in business for a couple or $3,000, and you can in Portland cook on the cart instead of having to do all your prep somewhere else. You can actually do the work there, which some other cities, you know, make quite difficult. But you know, you could be in business in Portland, and maybe not, you know, in well bankrolled, but you know, for $10,000. So it's kind of the equivalent of, I'll make another 1980s reference, my second in less than an hour. But you remember in the 80s when all the filmmakers were, you know, every story about a filmmaker was he maxed out his credit card so he could make his great independent film. It's the same thing here. I mean, you can take a chance. You can max out your Visa and buy a cart and open a cart and have a go at it and fail or succeed. And by the time, you know, in some of these cities that you've failed or succeeded, you know, you're only risking $10,000 or $20,000.
And sorry, go ahead, Ted.
Oh, Ben, I was just going to say, you know, one of the things John points out in his book, I found very interesting. I hadn't really looked at the economics of food carts. And, you know, as he points out, it costs just south of $1 million to like $900,000 to open a Chipotle restaurant and like $200,000 for a Subway. And so by contrast, you know, you can buy a used food truck, he says, for, you know, $10,000. And you obviously have a lot fewer salaries, less overhead and all that kind of stuff. You know, at the same time, you know, it's not, I don't think John or I want to, you know, convey the idea that this is a risk-free enterprise, but $10,000 risk is a lot different than almost $1 million.
Yeah, John, I've been surprised when I've been going back to the places that I wrote about in the book and new places too, how many people who are attending these signings and talks, and the talks become kind of, you know, discussions as much as they are me running my mouth, but how many of the people attending are people who want to start their own truck and, you know, are buying the book as kind of a survey of what's going on and trying to study the field. I didn't expect that. But there are a lot of people out there who are pondering this or in the middle of, you know, making a go of it.
And you close your book, John, with a pretty amusing story of your, one of your attempts. I guess you've taken a couple attempts at doing the street food vending thing. Tell us quickly, if you would, about New Orleans and your experience down there.
Sure. I worked a Lucky Dog cart in New Orleans for three nights. The idea was that that I would work a Lucky Dog cart in New Orleans on Bourbon Street for three nights leading up to New Year's Eve. And I worked at Conti and Bourbon, working that weenie cart, peddling gummy hot dogs on gummier buns. I learned a deep respect for the men and women who worked those carts, who worked the streets in New Orleans. And I worked one for three nights with a woman named Alice who kept me from getting my rear end whipped over and over again. You know, and it kept threatening drunks from, you know, wailing on me.
So it can be risky.
It can, you know, and to push out of the quarter, you know, pushing like a 600-pound metal weenie down Bourbon Street and across like six lanes of traffic at Canal as your metal weenie careens and, you know, in fishtails, you know, and you've got, you know, at this moment you've got $900 or $1,000. You've got the take of the night from working Bourbon Street in your pockets, you know, as you're trying to get back in the Lucky Dog den where they park all the Lucky Dog carts. It's scary stuff, you know, and you really learn to appreciate how hard it is for someone who is working the street selling food.
Ted Schuffer, give us a sense of where Salt Lake's street food scene is heading. Is it burgeoning? Are there more trucks in the wings, do you see, or have we maxed out?
I don't think so. I mean, I was just down at the Gallivan Center the other day for lunch, and there were seven or eight food trucks parked there, and there were lines at every single one of them. That was just in one location, you know. And so I don't think so. And I think, you know, part of the growth of trucks, I don't know if John talks about this in his book or not, but, you know, I don't think these places could exist without social social media, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, with a brick-and-mortar restaurant, you can, you know, find it in the Yellow Pages or, you know, it has an address on Yelp or Urban Spoon or wherever. And but with food trucks, you really need to know how to use Twitter and Facebook and internet sites and Foursquare and all this kind of stuff to let people know where you are, you know, because you're moving around. And so I think the more that, you know, I think that that's really enhanced the growth of food trucks, and I don't really see any end to it here. I suspect there will be, you know, if there are 6 trucks now on the Wasatch Front, I suspect by next summer there will be, you know, 25 or more. So I think it's a really booming business.
And John T. Edge, finally, about a minute left. You're hopeful about the possibilities for the future of street food. You say it's going to become less trendy. What do you see?
I think it will become less trendy. I think, you know, the 41st person that makes Korean tacos and, you know, is done for. But I think, and what I hope and what I'm seeing as I go back out on the road, is that there, you know, two types of trucks are growing. And those are new immigrants cooking the food of their place. I think that's a wonderful expression of this phenomenon. Was in New York a couple of weeks ago and had these wonderful arepas at a Colombian truck. And talking with the proprietor, she was so proud to share the food of her place. And that was what it was all about for her. And I think that style of cooking, that kind of approach is will endure. And it's one of the things I really admire. I think the other thing that we will see and we're beginning to see is walk away from the kind of codified styles, like we got to have donuts, we got to have banh mi, to an emphasis on regional food. So I'm looking forward to seeing the first pastrami cheeseburger truck, if there isn't already one in Salt Lake City.
That's the food writer and cultural historian John T. Edge. His most recent book is called The Truck Food Cookbook, and he'll be in Salt Lake tomorrow to sign copies of it. For more information, visit our website, radiowest.kuer.org. John, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Ted Scheffler, the dining editor for the Salt Lake City Weekly. Thank you very much for joining us, Ted.
You bet. I'm going to go try to find a Sonoran hot dog.
I'm Benjamin Bombard. This is Radio West.